And I want to introduce our keynote for this morning. David Lankus is a professor from Syracuse, and there was a marvelous comment that scrolled by a little while ago. Everyone should hear David once in a lifetime. And so I guess he's on the librarian's bucket list. And I'm delighted to turn this over to him. And David, take it away.
Good morning. I'm not quite sure from that comment if that was you should only hear me once, and if you hear me twice, it's a bad day, or the other way around. But anyway, hi all. Thanks for coming. I'm going to spend a little time with you this morning on some thoughts around reinventing librarianship and why we need to do that. I love being part of the virtual conference. I'm old enough now that being able to present from home is almost better than drinking hurricanes on Bourbon Street. That's how pathetic my social life is. But in any case, here we are. So let's get to it. I want to talk a little bit about reinventing librarianship and why I think we need to do it and why it's not a bad thing. I think we need to, I'll just give you the punchline at the end, I think we need to spend a lot more time going back to our fundamentals of what business we're in and not spend so much time with all the tools and new opportunities just chasing them. I think we need to be very selective, and for that, I think we need to understand our core. Now, to do that, I'd like to start talking about an environment where we're in the midst of great change. We're in a time of great social, technological, and social change. I want to talk about a time when there was a great challenge for the need for a venerable profession, where we talk about that profession where new understandings rise, and that leads to questions about current practice without providing new practice. Where a lack of wide-scale systems for refreshing professional skills and new understanding. Now, you probably already guessed the joke here, which is that I think a lot of this fits into today, I'm actually talking about physicians in the 1800s. If you have the chance, go buy this book, The Great Influenza, John M. Barry. It's one of my favorite books of all time. And while it may sound like really happy, fun summer reading about people dying of the flu, the truth is it really is about the rise of the medical profession in the 1800s, and particularly in the United States, and how it went from sort of people coming by and sitting next to you and hearing how you felt about things and handing you some bizarre potion made out of herbal remedies to what we know today as science that keeps people moving ahead and keeps them alive. The time of great technological and social change is we think that today we talk about the idea of polarizing discourse and the Republicans versus the Democrats, and these days the Republicans versus the Republicans versus the Tea Party versus what have you. But we're talking about, right after the Civil War, we're talking about a time when they literally had to, like, do an extra constitutional activity, the name of President of the United States, to pull troops out of the South during Reconstruction. I mean, this was a time that was not really happy, and we're talking about great polarization and the fact that we might even slip into another Civil War. And at the time, physicians weren't necessarily seen as the venerable profession that we think of them today. In fact, there were many a physician saying, we're all quacks. And the fact is that people probably would live longer, be healthier, if they didn't go see a doctor. There were calls to get rid of this idea of a medical profession, that in essence, everyone should be their own doctor, and we could train everyone in the skills of medicine, and we could do away with this whole professional. There was a great move against sort of elitism and the intellectual elite. Sound familiar? And so at this point, you know, why was this happening? Well, why this was happening is because people were getting sick, and doctors were trying to heal them and provide health to them, but we really didn't know what was making them sick. This was before germ theory. This was before the idea of truly mapping that this virus led to this ailment, that this bacteria led to this ailment, and that this medicine could solve it. And so what we were at a point with in medical history in the late 1800s was the idea that we knew that what we were doing wasn't working. We had a glimpse of what the future might look like, but we didn't have a firm enough understanding of what that future was to plan for it. So we had a situation where doctors were sitting there going, I know I could be much better. I know if I just try all this stuff, I could be better, but I don't know how to do it, and I don't know how to get retrained. And even if I went back for retraining, I don't know what they would teach me. Sound familiar? I mean, at this point, we're really talking about a situation where librarians probably had much bigger social capital and respect than physicians did at this time. And I want you to sort of keep that in the back of your mind, because I hear a lot of times when I talk about the importance and power of the profession, the idea that we can make librarianship more important, that we, our golden ages are ahead of us, people often go, ah, we're librarians. Yeah, we're librarians. And this would be the equivalent of a doctor getting up in 1860s and going, we can be an important profession that will drive most of the economy, and people would have laughed. I mean, in Harvard, the new president of the Harvard Medical School, late 1800s, wanted to implement, ready, a written exam at the end of their studies to become a doctor. The professors rose up against this guy because they said they can't do it because most of our students are illiterate. Most of the doctors they were training at Harvard Medical School couldn't read. Life changes. So here's this big mass of a Wordle, because we always have to have Wordles. Wordles are cool, just because I get to say the word Wordle. Well, we're in the same situation. We have this glimpse of the future, and we're saying, oh, my God, we know that Google Plus and Facebook and Twitter and all this stuff is changing the universe around us, and we know there's great capabilities. What the hell do we do with it? And we get stories talking about the idea that, you know, it changed democracy in Egypt, and it brought down this and all this other stuff, but we're not quite sure what to do with it. And people are raising questions about, do we need librarians? You know, here they are, and what librarians are doing is books and materials and all this other stuff is not that different than saying, well, here are physicians, and all they're doing is putting leeches on you and bleeding you. And they know they can do better, but they don't know where to be. Now, the reason I bring up this whole story is that, you know, it's interesting to see how that profession, and can we map from that profession, and how they move forward to how we move forward. So, for example, when we sit there and we talk about what is the future of librarianship, you know, we come up with this sort of interesting mix. Is our future, let's see if I can use the fancy technology here, is our future the vault, where we're just the stuff that's too delicate or we can't do without the physical item, and what we're going to become is, in essence, the nation's archive? That we're going to be a special collection shop sitting alone, and we'll keep track of those things that no one else needs. Now, I got to tell a quick story. I teach here at SU, and I teach a doctoral seminar. And I was teaching a doctoral seminar in library and information science. And as part of that, we started talking about the mission of libraries. And we got into this conversation about stories that librarians tell to show that they're important. What is the sort of marketing message that says libraries are still important? And I said, you know, it's interesting is that 10 years ago, really from the rise of the web to about 10 years ago, the story was, well, not everything will be digitized. There's just too much physical stuff. We'll never digitize at all. And here were 11 doctoral students of varying age from 40 down, and they all simultaneously laughed. They all in that moment said, what do you mean not everything's going to be digitized? Of course it is. They just took it as fact that it was going to be digitized. I mean, we really went from a situation where we thought the value of libraries was we have all this important physical artifacts and we'll never come up with digital versions of it. And then we had the Google Digitization Project where sitting there at Harvard, their biggest debate was how do we get trucks on Harvard Yard to haul away the materials that's going to be digitized. Now, was it a perfect solution? Is it going to be a perfect copy? Do we still need physical items before you start ranting? Yes. But it's interesting we don't make that argument anymore. By the way, another argument we don't make, have you noticed? We don't make the information overload argument anymore. No one talks about information overload anymore. They you know, we've coped. We've figured out mechanisms. Or are we going to be, is the future of the profession the sort of apocalyptic, you know, Mel Gibson-esque, without the anti-Semitic ranting, road warrior vision where, you know, we get rid of all the public institutions and everything becomes a matter of commercial access behind walled gardens and through stewardship by the commercial sector where Google and Apple and their app store have all our data, right? That's the other future. Or are we the sort of islands of expertise where each, we devolve the number of libraries, but each library becomes a set of sort of PhD staffed area experts and such. So we have all these different futures that are being projected. These are obviously sort of the negative ones, but the idea is, where are we going to be? Where are we going to move from this point that the doctors were in? Well, as I said, I might be instructed to look at what the doctors didn't do. Physicians in this situation did not become stethoscope experts. When you talk about physicians, the way they evolved, the way they moved from this sort of do we need them and everyone's going to be a doctor, like everyone's going to be a librarian, do we move that by becoming the scalpel people? Do we move that by becoming the instrumentation people? Do we do that by becoming, you know, people interested in the art of the tools of our profession and not what we do. Because the truth is, they didn't. When doctors evolved and when doctors thought forward, they didn't go to the tools they used to do what they were currently doing. We're not our tools, as someone put in that comment. They, in fact, went to what they were supposed to be doing, which was finding the fundamental of nature of how the body worked. They went back to their core. So even though doctors, you know, we've evolved from X-ray machines looking like this to MRI machines looking like this, that actually wasn't so much the doctors doing it. Those were allied professions who were improving and creating profession, creating new tools in conjunction with doctors. And so even while both of these may be images of what medicine looks like, of examples of medical evolution, when we think about doctors, when we think about medicine, we still very much have this image before us, right? We think about medicine, we still think of it as an innately human activity. While we want to get the x-rays, while we want to get, you know, the MRI, we want to take the blood test, what we really want to do is sit down with someone who knows what they're doing and saying, how's it going? This is what you should do. This is what's happening in your body. Here are some suggestions about what's going on. Medicine, while it has become increasingly technical, while it has become increasingly medical, while they completely changed their view of how the body works, of how physicians treat people, they kept the fact that it was a human, an innately human activity. I saw a post of someone talking about, can't libraries get off the fact of talking about an idealistic utopian future of digital this and digital that and gets back to the point of we're people helping people? And the answer is yes, and we need to fundamentally do that. What's interesting is when e-commerce exploded and the web exploded, we started talking about disintermediation, this term that we're going to get rid of all middlemen. We're going to get rid of everyone that stands between me and my data, me and my task, me and my activity. And we saw some great gains and some great activities that happened from that. We saw health insurance and life insurance costs drop dramatically because it turns out that the intermediaries were keeping information from people to make proper decisions. And the minute sunshine came into that effort, the minute we got rid of these middlemen that actually added no value, the market came to bear. But we see professions like medicine, like law. We see many professions where we realize that they were never intermediaries. They were facilitators. They were fundamental to the process. They added value to it. And so when I think about the future of the profession, when I think about a new librarianship, when I talk about our way forward throughout this chaos, it is never about we need better tools, we need better Google Pluses, we need better ebook readers, we need better licensing, we need better catalogs. By the way, we need better catalogs, we need better licensing, we need better ebooks, but that's not fundamentally what we do. What we really need is a new understanding where we can make sense, where we can not just simply be a less, you know, adding no value intermediary and become a true facilitator of knowledge, a true understander of what's going on. So the new librarianship that I want to talk about is not about better MRI machines and better such. It's not about the fact of what social media should we be jumping on. It's about looking at what we as the professionals, we as the core of the profession, we as the fundamental value of librarianship, librarians, can do. I mean, you have to understand that we're in a world now where our collections are becoming less and less valuable each day, and librarians are becoming more and more valuable each day. But we're not going to do that by caretaking the collection. We're not going to do that by becoming the tool people. We're going to do that by going back to the fundamentals of what it is we want to try and do. So what are the fundamentals of what we're trying to do? Well, here it is, right? The most fundamental thing is we're here for someone else. We are a profession completely carved out, engineered, thought of as a service profession. We're here to help this user. Now, the problem is that this idea of users, I really hate this idea of users. But first of all, no one works in a vacuum, right? We're talking about people, and people exist in a social setting. It can be a very limited social setting, but it can be a very expansive social setting. It's their how they were raised, their relationships to their family, their relationships to their extended family, their relationship to the community they live in, the relationship with their friends, the relationships with their colleagues. This context around the user matters. So we already understand that the idea of a user-based design, where we take this user and we say, what do you need? And we take them out of that context, doesn't work. we can't take people out of context. We can't assume that they're going to come to our reference desk, ask a question, and be a blank slate that we can just hand them information and inform them. The truth is, whatever information we provide them is going to have a context they're going to relate it to. I mean, from the most fundamental step, when they step into the library, they walk up to a reference desk. Are you white? Are you tall? Are you male? Are you female? What accent do you have? That's context. Are they in a hurry? Are they got plenty of time to do it? Is this for work? Is this for pleasure? Who's telling them to do this? All that context is essential, and it matters. And by the way, it doesn't just matter at the reference desk. It matters at the catalog. It matters at the book. It matters at the website. It matters in how we put forward bond issues and levies and tuition statements. It matters. So we know that they're in a social context. Now, we know that they are trying, they're in this sort of situation where they've got a gap, right? So the first thing we've got to get rid of is this user is trying to solve a problem. Now, I hate the word user. I said it before, I'll say it again. Drug dealers and computer programmers have users. We have members. No, Dave, we have patrons. We always use the word patrons. I hate the word patrons. I hate it. It sounds to me like we have people paying us to do oil paintings. It comes from patronage. I don't like that. This is one I stole from Joan Fry Williams, who during the midst of a sort of strategic planning process said, hey, I got a crazy idea. Let's ask them. Are they customers? Are they consumers? Are they patrons? What are they? And they came back and they said, we're members. In a public library context, I pay to be a member. I pay my taxes. I got a card. Hey, I got a tote bag. Whatever it is. If they're students, they're paying tuition. If they're in a business, they're paying the bottom line. They're members. They're part of us. They belong. They have ownership. They don't simply consume and walk away. They're participants. What I was talking with in Dallas, and they said, you know, they're neighbors. And I love that. I mean, neighbors may work very well in a social and school context. It may not work so well in other contexts, but the idea of it, as someone that we are beholden to and that we have an obligation and we have a communication with on a regular basis, that we are part of each other's context. So this member in a social context is trying to solve a problem, and we are trying to provide the solution. The information it takes, the resources it takes to solve that problem, to bridge that gap, that process is learning. And I don't care if you're trying to figure out something to do your, you know, midterm exam on, or you're trying to solve your third grade paper, or you're trying to get resources to go into court with and depose someone. I don't care if you're a doctor looking for a treatment. You are learning. The fundamental process and what librarians do when we look at the root of it is learning. Just like the doctors had to go back and say, what's going on? What's this virus? What's this bacteria? What's this pathology? What does it do to this organ? They started with what was going on in the body, not with, why is my stethoscope not working properly? Why is my catalog not working properly? Because you're trying to solve the wrong problem. The catalog is solving an inventory problem. You need to be solving a learning problem. So what we see then is that is ultimately our mission. The mission of librarians, not of libraries or buildings, not of facilities, not of org charts, but of you, of people. The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. So, a couple things to know. First, it's about you. Secondly, it's about improving society. There is an activist role in librarianship. Librarianship is not simply about being passive and fulfilling any request regardless of its purpose or its context. It is about improvement. And I got in trouble with saying this before, so let me add a little context around that. Improvement is defined as by a conversation between you and your community. What is better for this community? Because it may not be the same for all communities. Does this community, is economic development essential to this community? Is recreation essential to this community? Is research essential to this community? Is profit essential to this community? What do we define by improve? And we do it by facilitating. Now, what do I mean by facilitating? Well, there's sort of four major ways we facilitate. The first one is access. We're good at that. Oh, we love that. We've built a couple thousand years of practice around that. And that's the idea that if knowledge is sitting there, if we just get people access to it, we're good. And it is essential. You must have access to the conversations in order to build knowledge. But it's insufficient. the idea here is it's like taking a two-year-old, setting them loose in the stacks for a week, coming back in a week and assuming they can read. That doesn't work that way. You need to not only provide access to it, but you need to provide the basic knowledge. There's a chance that some of the folks in this listening audience are taking notes, minimal, I guarantee you. And they may be taking it in a language other than English. They may be writing it in Chinese or Spanish or what have you. Now, if I look at those notes in another language, because I'm language disabled, I will get nothing from them. I need to know what is that language. I need to know how to speak that language. Just like if the conversation's going on online. Well, that's great. I don't know how to use a mouse. Is that conversation going on in the partners at a law firm? Okay. I need to understand some basics of the legal practice before I can move in there. I need to understand the culture I'm going into. So access is insufficient. Knowledge is essential. And when you look at librarianship, you look at instructional librarianship, and you look at information problem-solving curricula, you look across this idea, we've known that instruction is important. We just sort of forgot that the instruction should be much more about their problem and less about learning about us. You know, it's like bibliographic instruction, BI. Please find any examples of that. Find it and delete it. It's horrible. The idea of how to use us better. Who cares? They want to know how they solve their problem better and then how they can solve the problem after that. And then the environment in which they do that. So when this member comes in, they have access to a conversation, access to material, to information they need to solve the problem. And so most often that's another member of a community, by the way. They know how to participate, whether it's in a, you know, how in a social way, how in a technical way, or not. We have to make sure that they feel comfortable doing it, right? So you get things like the Patriot Act. You get the idea of how we build up this idea of sort of intellectual security. Environment is all about providing a safe environment. For some of you, this idea of presenting in a virtual conference is a much better environment to learn on than going down to New Orleans. One, it's safer in the sense that I don't have to be with all those crazy people, or I don't have to be out eating etouffee, or I have time to think about it, or I'm in a comfortable spot. Public libraries provide physical safety to after-school kids. Academic libraries provide intellectual safety by allowing it to browse a wide variety of information without tracking. This idea that we must provide a safe environment to do it in. And by the way, that goes very much to our instruction as well. And finally, motivation. Librarians need to understand in our new librarianship why people want to know, why they are learning. And I know that that sounds like it's at odds with privacy, but we have to understand that. We've already seen the idea of an imposed query is different from someone who comes up with their own query. My teacher made me do this. What is that? We know that's different than, I really want to know. I was just talking with a school board about school librarians, and I said, you know, what you have in an academic setting in the K-12 environment is you have the one place in the curriculum that has slack for inquiry and passion. You have students that are locked into standardized testing and core curriculum and standards this and achievement that, and they can walk into the library and they can say, but what I really care about are snakes, astronomy, what have you. And they can synthesize all that other standardized information together in a model of inquiry that they've never known before. Barbara Stripling talks about the idea of moving from knowledge to understanding. And while I would keep those phrases together, it's a really interesting, the major difference is motivation. You know what the temperature is out today. Do you care? You know how tall Mount Everest is. Do you care? Well, if you're on an airplane that has a certain height, altitude limit, you care a lot. You're highly motivated. So we need to understand motivation. We need to understand about learning theory. We need to understand what's going on. Someone just asked the question, what separates information from knowledge? I'll just come right out and say, I have no idea what information is. I don't. I'm about to talk to all our incoming students and new librarians. I'm going to tell them we're in an information school that doesn't understand what information is, and that's okay. But I know what knowledge is. Knowledge is action. Knowledge is that we understand internally that affects how we work externally. It's what affects our behavior. It's what affects our answers and how we approach situations. I don't think we're in the information business. I don't think we've ever been in the information business. I think librarianship has always been in the knowledge business. And knowledge takes a much keener understanding than simply handing someone materials or pointing to materials or bringing materials together and saying, there, go. It must involve the entire inquiry process from Why do you care about it? To what are you going to do? To how did you do? It's about learning. It's about knowledge. So when we look at this view, this librarianship view, we move to the idea that, you know, we need to reimagine our library. Right now, the library is a collection of collections. You look at the library and you talk about databases. You talk about, well, we got our databases over here. We got 3 million of them and we put them all in alphabetical order. Congratulations. Good luck. We have a repository. Repositories, you know, is the stuff where we put all the dead papers that no one's going to read again, whatever it is. We have our digital library, things we digitize, then we have our catalogs. And so we've really sort of done our org charts around this, we've done our practice around this, we have acquisitions process, we have policies, we've sort of said the library is this collection of collections. But what I want you to think about is, instead of thinking of the library as a collection of collections, think of it as a collection of member libraries. It's a collection of members. Where these members are having conversations, these members are consulting materials and resources, these members are creating material and content, they're podcasting and blogging, and they're reading these materials, they're reading books and such, and they're conversing with each other, hey, this is a good book, try that, hey, try this, hey, I just learned yesterday, etc. And the conversations, what they're having is they're referencing things that are in our resources, in our repositories, in our databases, our catalogs, but also on the web, and also in their personal collections. In Ann Arbor, Eli Nyberger was talking about a conversation with a patron. He said, you know how I can go to the catalog in Ann Arbor and I can find a book, and that book says it's either here at the Central Library or it's at this branch, and I can borrow it from whatever branch? Yeah. I got stuff at home. Can I put my stuff in the catalog so people can borrow my stuff, and then I can borrow their stuff? Now, if you think about the library as a collection of stuff that we own, control, or license, that makes no sense. But if you think about it as a collection of users, it makes brilliant, perfect sense. By the way, would you put yourself in the catalog because you have expertise in the Civil War or medicine or what have you? And suddenly, we are really facilitating knowledge within the community, not simply access to stuff that we can afford or can't afford. Right? That we need to reimagine the library. This is your collection, and what a truly awesome collection it is. More massive and sprawling than anything in ancient Alexandria. It's composed of seniors who have seen their life expectancy in America nearly double from 40 to 70 years old over the past 50 years? Imagine the vast sea of expertise and unbridled talent unencumbered by profit and seeking impact and legacy. Our collection is in children, realizing that our concept of childhood was only truly born in the labor laws of the 1800s and the rise of a middle class that did not depend upon the income of youth. Our collection is in women who, from the right to vote to the majority of college degrees, including doctorates, in under 100 years. In under 100 years, this population has gone from disenfranchised to the most educated part of our population. Right? We see our collection in minorities, too long ignored, and now actively enriching and expanding the culture of opportunity. Minorities that will soon actually make up the majority of the United States. This is your collection. This is your business. And what's more, this collection doesn't come with a 28 circulation limit. It isn't beholden to outdated concepts of intellectual property. And on the bright side, no one will ever question if your collection is becoming obsolete. Something to think about. So it's now important that we think ahead. We have to throw in some technology examples and why this may change. And so what I want you to think about is, to this point, if you wanted to bring the library as conceptualized to people, you had to put a diesel engine in front of it and call it a bookmobile. And now, with smartphones, we're able to at least take access to resources and materials about it. But there's this really cool concept called geofencing. Geofencing rises from the fact that every cell phone, smart, dumb, or otherwise, that you walk around with has a GPS unit in it. They have to have it for 911 coverage, at least in the United States. Every cell phone knows where it is. And what you can do is you can set up areas. You can say, well, when I walk into this building, remind me to do something. When I walk out of this building, remind me to do something. So you sort of set up a virtual fence around a geographic location. Your phone knows where you are in relation, and that can trigger events. So in the new Apple operating system that they're about to come out with, they have reminders. And so you can say, well, when I go to the grocery store, remind me to get milk. And so literally, as you walk into the grocery store, up pops on your phone, get milk. But this idea of geofencing can go much further. So if we look at learning, we look at knowledge, we look at the library being really librarian and expertise and members, imagine now that when Katrina hits, you want to set up a library for victims. You want to set up a library for people who have lost their homes. You don't have to build a building. You don't have to get a, you know, formaldehyde-infested trailer to do it. You literally have to walk down with your smartphones and say, anyone who walks in this area has access to the business collection. Anyone over here has access to reference. Anyone over here has access to housing. Everyone over here. And then not only can librarians set up a virtual library in a field, in a tornado impact site, but we can hand those phones then in our members. Anytime you walk in and say, well, this person's a doctor, he's willing to share his medical expertise. He walks by you, it pings that you're looking for medical information, there's a connection made. And the library starts and facilitates that conversation. Right? Library after library has created apps where we can find the stuff. What about apps that let us find the people, find the members, find the expertise, find the information, and not just in our physical buildings, but anywhere in our community? And it doesn't fit nicely into a catalog, but it's real action. I can be walking through the streets of Rome, walk up to the Trevi Fountain and say, gee, I wish I knew a little bit more about this. And it says, oh, there are 15 librarians that you've just triggered who are ready to answer your questions and a tour guide and this information. And that's the collection that we can organize and we can bring power to and that we can combine and work with. That's where we can go if we stop worrying about our policies and our procedures and buying stuff and licensing stuff and move back to what we've been always about, which is knowledge, which is communities, which is organizing them. We need to get out of collection management and we need to get to connection management. We need to get out of the idea that stuff is our value and back to the idea that the community is the value and our value to that community is helping it learn better, faster, easier. So, what we need to think about is that a library doesn't have to look a given way. The library doesn't have to be a piece, you know, it doesn't have to reference here and collections here and stacks on the third floor. It amazes me that as I travel the world, I can walk into a library in Sweden and I can walk into a library in North Dakota and they look the same. I'm sorry, those communities aren't the same. I can walk into a library in the middle of Maine, which has a tourist season, which triples the population every summer. And it looks the same as if I walked into New York City. That boggles my mind. If what we're really doing is facilitating the community, if we need to shape ourselves around that community, is your library, for example, the People's Learning Academy? When you look at your community, is its most important thing how it learns? For example, what just scares the hell out of me, and adult education brings these statistics up, is that in areas that have prisons, the prison population has a better level of academic achievement and a higher degree earning than the community that surrounds it because we support and we fund it for the prisoners but not for the people around it. Can we look at libraries and public libraries as places where people learn? They do. Can we then certify it? Why not go to our state departments of education and say, you know how a university can give out a degree? Why can't my public library do that? Why can't my school library do that? If I find up here in North Syracuse, they have someone come in monthly to give a lecture and talk about Civil War. He's a Civil War buff, a Civil War historian, has no degree in it, but has expertise because he's learned it partially at the library. And he's built a community that comes and has that discussion. His job is as a warehouse worker, but that's his passion. Can we as a library certify that passion? Can we recognize that passion? Can we credential that? Does our community need that? What about publisher of the community? When that person wants to write a book, when that person wants to write a blog post, when a mom's club wants to get up and give information, can we provide the platform in which they can share that information out? Can we become the publisher so that when people come to the library, they don't come to learn about every place but where the library is. They come to learn about that community. For example, in Philadelphia, they talked about creating areas where people could go and compose music. People could not only compose it, they could perform music. And the library would collect it, would collect the audio, would collect that material, and could publish it out. So if you wanted to know about the Philadelphia music scene, you went to the library to actually experience it. Is that what your library looks like? Is your library an innovation center? Not a place where we're looking to help people find existing jobs, but where we're helping them to create whole new jobs. One of my favorite stories is a fellow up in Vermont who loves snowmobiles so much to the point where he collected old snowmobiles and snowmobile parts, and by the time he was a grandfather, he had a barn full of snowmobile parts. His grandson comes home from college, and with his permission, went back into the barn, took a picture of every snowmobile part, cataloged it, organized it, put it online, and instantaneously that grandfather became an international distributor of snowmobile parts and materials. People in Siberia with snowmobiles that are 40 years old couldn't find parts for them. Suddenly they were buying from Vermont. Here's a whole new world that builds upon that person's passion to share it. We treat jobs as if it's somehow they're out there, these little units, and we put people in them. We slot them. We need to start thinking about jobs as how do we monetize people's passion? How do we let them make a career by what they love? And can the library be a place to do that? And while that sounds like, oh, there are all these dramatic different ways and these libraries are going to look different and suddenly we're going to fragment and it's going to become even more chaos than it is not now, at the root, at the core of that is librarianship. At the center of all this richness and amazing diversity of communities lies the facilitating role of librarians. Doing as they have done throughout history, helping communities and members make better decisions to learn and grow from their knowledge. For the root of all of this is learning and knowledge, not stuff and materials and policies and practices and an MLS degree. The root of our profession, what makes our profession, is this central question. And the central question is not what is information, and it is not how do I organize the world's materials, and it's God help me, not about recorded knowledge. It is about how our communities get better, how they learn, how they understand. The root of what we do is about learning and unlocking potential. You want to go and have a discussion with your city council, with your principal, with your dean, with your chancellor, with your law partner, with whatever it is. Having a discussion about we're really good licensors is becoming a rather boring conversation. Having a discussion about we're really good at finding stuff like search engines is becoming a rather dull conversation. Saying we unlock your knowledge and passion and potential, and then giving 20 real examples of people who have improved their lives, that's a powerful message. What we ultimately must do is we must invent our future. We have to rewrite our mission statement. If your mission statement starts with the library shall, rewrite it. The library can't do anything other than decay and exert gravity. Librarians shall. The librarians of Syracuse shall. The librarians of Syracuse University shall. People. It's people doing it. Once again, back to the medical example. You don't go to a hospital and say, oh, the hospital cured me. The doctor that did it, the nurse that did it, the volunteer, the candy striper, the person who helped you understand something, the lab technician, the people that improved your health. That's what we worry about. Why is it in librarianship we think the mission is all about the institution we work with? The mission is about the people doing work at the institution. We need to create profession-wide outcomes. So here you are. You now had to sit through my speech. You probably had a much more interesting time yesterday in which you were learning and talking and learned lots of stuff. How did it improve your knowledge of the profession? What is the core knowledge of the profession? In New York State, if you want to be a public librarian, every 5 years you have to have 60 course hours to renew your certification. What's the curriculum for that? What are the core knowledges? What do we need to know? How do we learn? When you send your staff to these virtual webinars, how is that fulfilling their requirement for continuing education? How does it fit into a curriculum? How does it improve this profession? We need to define grand challenges. And the grand challenge of librarianship is not staying employed. The grand challenge of librarianship is not collecting it all. The grand challenges of librarianship is improving those communities. It's taking communities that are faced with war and famine and unemployment and housing issues and making those communities better. That's a grand challenge. We must dream bigger, right? The time for introspection is done. The time for trivia is done. The time for looking for the future of libraries and catalogs and strategic plans is done. The need of our communities is too great and our promise for improvement too large. Our families worry about jobs and the ability to fight their way into a shrinking middle class. Our education system is broken. Students unable to learn or drowning under crushing debt. Our system of government increasingly polarized, our appetites for energy unsustainable, and the very memory of our society eroding behind walls of commerce and false scarcity. These are our grand challenges. And just as the physicians before us, if we rise to meet them, we too shall be rewarded. And I know what you're thinking. I know that tomorrow you'll be dealing with broken printers and shelving backlogs and the rising cost of subscriptions, but you must look up. You must never make what you do replace why you do it. And if you can't link broken printers and shelving to the grand challenges of our society, then you ought to ask, why are you doing them? We must stop reacting to the world around us and start inspiring it. Now, these are just words. If all I do is preach them and return to my ivory tower, I've committed the sin of hypocrisy and vanity. But you, if you cry hallelujah and wait, and then wait to seize the opportunity that you have committed, you've committed an equally great sin, the sin of omission. If you stay silent, or wait for change, or take the easy path, or see yourself as less than capable, less than worthy, then you leave our precious communities to lesser goals and flawed stewards. We must not let this happen. Thank you very much. And I think we have time for questions if I didn't roll over.
No, we're in great shape. So please have those questions, put them in the chat window, and David can field them.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I just missed a good one.
Okay, well, here's one. How do you suggest librarians begin this conversation with their staff? Because I imagine that there would be a little hesitancy in some circles.
Absolutely. You know, I think part of it is to begin to focus, just as we need to work with our communities to unlock their passion, to find out what they're passionate about, and if we're facilitating, if we help someone discover, act upon, utilize their passion, they'll love us forever. They'll help us in boats, they'll help us in tuition, they'll help us everywhere. Same thing with our staff. If we can discover what the passion is of our staff and we can utilize that power, then our institutions will be better. The other thing we have to realize is sometimes those passions will be better served in institutions other than when they're currently working, and deal with that. But the short term of how to begin this conversation is to start by asking what the community needs. Not what the community thinks about the library, or not even what they need in the library. Start by saying, what are the major community groups that we want to serve? And I'm using the community as a very broad term. Community of geographic, community of municipality, community of students, community of faculty, community of lawyers. What conversations, what problems are they facing? Is it, for example, at a small liberal arts college I was working with, it was, what's the new core? What's a liberal arts core look like now? In another city library, it was, how do we do economic development? Everything's about economic development. In a school library, it was, how do we help people become readers? All right, students, all right, let's take a university. It's faculty, it's staff, it's students, excuse me, it's parents, it's alumni, etc. All right, what problems are those different subgroups trying to solve? Our curriculum, our core, and we map them out. And then what we can do is we say, are there any regularities? Well, yeah, for example, if we want to know what the core is, there's this town hall meeting and then a suggested curriculum and then a Senate meeting, et cetera. Then draw a line of all the services that your library offers and see if you can draw a connection between the conversations your community's having and what you're providing. If you have any boxes that have no lines to them, in other words, the faculty wants to do this but we're not supporting it, ask yourself, is that where should we be? And if you have any services that don't go to any parts of the conversation, seriously ask whether you want to continue that service. That process of sort of strategic planning, mission planning, mapping conversations provides enough distance between you and the staff that you're not sitting there going, we need to change. As someone once said, Bob Wedgeworth, former ALA president, said to me, never rally the troops until you're ready to give them marching orders. In other words, getting them excited in this speech, and I really appreciate it, and I hope it got people excited, but if you didn't have specific tasks to do, see my book now, then it doesn't help. So you need to have action. And so this idea of mapping community conversations, mapping your services to them, that process is something they can do. It gives you a way of beginning that conversation.
Can I shift gears a second to how you assess the how you measure community improvement as you get members involved and develop new partnerships?
Yep, that's a great question. This idea of outcomes is vitally important, right? What are we trying to accomplish? And that is a conversation with the community, with what good old-fashioned political science calls a social compact. right? So where the community and the library come together and in equal parts have a conversation about what that library is going to do. That's going to result in a series of outcomes. Outcomes such as improved employment, outcomes such as improved learning, standardized test scores. Those are things we can then become measurable around. And, you know, my colleague Megan Oakleaf has done a brilliant job in talking about how to do outcomes-based assessment and such, and there's lots of knowledge about that. But it begins with a conversation about what problems are we trying to solve. This is an example where I think school libraries have done brilliantly. I mean, when I look at all the people out there that are making a case for libraries, school libraries, and I don't necessarily think that they've done the best job in making the case, unfortunately. There's a whole issue there. But what they've done is they've provided brilliant evidence. When I can walk up to that school board I was talking about saying, you can't get rid of the school librarian because schools that have a certified school librarian have improved test scores on quantitative and qualitative measures, and here's that data. That's incredible data that we can pull out and show that we're having that impact, but it begins with what are those outcomes? And those outcomes, we're looking at standardized test scores. We don't have those in every setting. Sometimes it's bottom line. Sometimes in the U.S. Department of Justice, it's effectiveness of prosecution. It's effectiveness of defense, et cetera. But we need outcomes in order to measure that against it. So this doesn't, you know, this idea of new librarianship doesn't change the fact that we must assess our outcomes. It simply says that our outcomes need to be much more about what the community needs to accomplish and much less about what happens within our walls.
And I think the person who asked in the context of K-12 where they are in such a dominant assessment-driven education culture may feel a little at odds with that sometimes.
Well, and I don't disagree with that, and this is where getting to the principal and the superintendent still matters a lot and saying, look, we're your SWAT team. You have in all of these silos, in all these curricular area silos, you have measures and reporting and data and just so much overhead in terms of watching yourself that it's a miracle that we ever actually get to teaching anything. In the school library, we have the ability, without those shackles, to do some amazing stuff. Here's your Slack. Here's the stuff that you got into education for. Here's when you talk about inspiring students and you're having a hard time understanding how coming up with 300 reports to the state about how we use standard, you know, correlated statistics to do standard X, Y, or Z. Here, you can do it in the library. You look at what Buffy Hamilton, you look at what Joyce Salenz do with kids and media understanding and literacy and transliteracy, and you just, I've never seen a superintendent look at what's going on in transliteracy and go, oh, who cares about that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you give them that little joy that they can get back to why they got into the profession. And I think that's true, by the way, in higher education. I think that's true in just about any educational setting. The other thing is that I don't believe that we are teachers. I believe that we're in the learning business. We're not directing and putting knowledge in people's heads. We are facilitating them creating knowledge on their own. This gets me in trouble because I'm a constructivist and not everyone is. But this idea that what we do is we create a condition whereby people learn and discover as opposed to direct and force. And that's a radically different understanding. And I've seen state libraries and other institutions that at one point were trying to partner with formal K-12 education, now running in the opposite direction because they don't want to get stuck in that highly evaluative context, but also they understand that there is something radically different going on now, that students are learning in a very different way than they used to, and that libraries are perfectly situated to take advantage of what we used to call informal learning or lifelong learning. It's all learning. And libraries, as the idea of the guide on the side, are perfectly situated to work in that environment. Whether you're guiding a third grader, a senior, a master's student, a lawyer, a doctor, a president, it doesn't matter.
Let's shift again to the question of finding out, or how do you handle when community needs, figuring out what your community needs, and what if they're different, what they think they need is different from what they really need.
That's a great question. We all in our lives should surround ourselves with people who are smarter than us. Never let them know that. But I hope Eli is not listening. But I'm going to pick on Eli Nyberger again. He talked about his favorite comment. They got a sort of an online comment form. What can the library do to make it better? And the comment was, and I may get this wrong, but it was more or less, more pie and prostitutes. And the reason I thought, one, it's hilarious, but two, you know, if we want people to come in our doors, if that's the number we want, you know, prostitution and baked goods, we maybe not the prostitution so much, but we certainly put cafes everywhere. It's just the next step. But we don't, we say that's not what we're about. You know, this idea that we're not just free DVDs, that we're not just, you know, Blockbuster that hasn't closed yet, et cetera. This comes from the idea that there is a dialogue that occurs, that librarians are not transparent and they're not unbiased. There is no way in the world to be unbiased. If you have anywhere in your mission statement or your training or in your thinking you said, we are unbiased, you're not. You have a huge bias. The most fundamental bias that's in the midst of all librarianship is that we believe that more information, more resources, access to more diverse views is better than fewer. That's a bias. That's a professional belief. It's a philosophy, and it colors everything we do. You also have biases. Joe Janes, another one of my sort of constellation of brilliant people I listen to, Joe Janes talked about, you know, when someone walks up to the reference desk and asks you a question, if you start typing first or reaching for the book behind you, that's a bias. You have built-in ways of accommodating the world. So first, we must acknowledge that, and we must say that they're values. They're important to us. And so when we have this conversation with our community, which we might do through our library board, which we might do through the PTG, that we might do through the school board, that we might do through the dean's council, that we might do wherever, we have to understand that we're coming in with a point of view, and that point of view is valid, that a conversation is not us sitting and listening and then delivering on what we heard. It's engaging in an active dialogue. And just as we are in the learning business, we understand that what people say and what they mean are not the same thing. The worst question you can ask anyone is, what do you want? Because most of the time, people don't know. We're going to design a new catalog. What do you want in our catalog? Their answer is going to be, well, I don't like this about the current one. They're really good at telling you what they don't want now. They're really horrible about telling you what they want in the future. So don't ask that question. Start with, what problem are you trying to solve? Prioritize the communities in terms of who's the most person that we have to satisfy or serve the most. Is it children? Is it teachers? Is it whatever it is? And then ask what problems they're trying to solve and align yourself to those problems. But have that dialogue and say, you know what, that's a problem we can't solve. Or that's a dialogue that you haven't given us the resources to solve, but we can help you and we need the resources to do it. But it is an ongoing dialogue in which we are equal parties and equal players. And so part of it starts with librarians needing a very strong backbone and believing in their values and more than what they learned in library school, but acting them out on a daily basis. And unbiased is not one.
Okay, we are about at a point where we need to wrap up. I'll let you pick the last question, David.
Oh, I've been talking out. let me just make a final comment, and
okay,
then we'll run away in my last 20 seconds here, which is, folks, I really, honest to God, deep in my heart, believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. I believe that we are going to be in a golden age where people are learning every day of their life, and they understand that. That people are accessing a diversity of resources and opinions, where we are interacting with people all across the globe in different opinions, different ideas, and the richest understanding we have of the world before us. But we do that. We bring about that golden age not by sitting back, but by finding the toughest problems to solve. That librarians must be ruthless in seeking out things they don't know if they can do and doing them. That we must find the hardest question that has the most value and solve that problem, not the easy stuff like how to search against the collection. And I know we can do it. And I look forward to continuing that conversation. There's a website here. There's a Twitter feed. Please, please, please join us. You know, I got the book, but just from the comments and the discussions, please talk. If you, in the middle of this, you said, Dave, you're full of crap, tell me. Say it out loud. Let's have a conversation about this. Thanks very much. Have a great day and have a great rest of the conference. Thanks for Learning Times and ALA for putting this together. You guys do a brilliant job as always.
So thank you so much, David. It was really our pleasure. And with that, kind audience, if you will just stay tuned, we will reset the room and be back in 5 minutes.